Welcome, everyone, to the February 2011 session of the International MD Support Group. I'm Dan Roberts, along with Dr. Ed Huggett, and our guest this month is Maurice Perret. When the National Federation of the Blind decided to co-sponsor a Mount Everest expedition, they needed someone who knew something about computers and blindness to handle communications at the base camp. So they called Maurice Perret, who will tell us more about that historic event and his part in it a little later. According to the NFB, the key ingredient in reaching that level of accomplishment is the perfection of alternative techniques to do equally those things that are expected of people with healthy vision. And that is the objective of low vision rehabilitation centers everywhere. Maurice Perret is a rehabilitation trainer for senior services at Blind Industries and Services of Maryland in Baltimore. I'll ask him later to tell us a little about his Mount Everest experience, but the main portion of our interview will deal with how we can maintain our quality of life and much of our independence by learning non-visual, daily living skills to either replace or supplement our vision. In tandem with today's session, I've included the first part of a series in our newsletter called A Self-Help Guide to Non-Visual Skills. We'll also be discussing that a little more later in the interview, and I hope you'll be encouraged to take part in the self-evaluation and lessons that will follow in the coming months. I think we'll just launch right into the questions that I have for you today. And I want to thank you for taking part in our MD List discussion group on the Internet. You've just joined us, and I know the people there are really learning a lot from you, and I'm going to encourage them to listen to this session today as well. So we're going to put the questions on the screen as we go through. And by the way, the screen, if you can't see that, is a beautiful shot that I found of Mount Everest. And I believe that's either at sunrise or sunset, but the sun is shining beautifully over the mountains on the left side of the screen. Mount Everest is the tallest peak on the right side, and the questions are overlaid over that beautiful picture. The first question, Maurice, is tell us how you became blind and how that led you to go into your line of work as rehabilitation trainer for senior services at the Blind Industries and Services of Maryland. Maurice?
Yes, Dan, thank you. How I came to work at Blind Industries is a bit circuitous, but I went blind in infancy and grew up doing most of the normal things that children do, not really identifying myself really as blind per se, just knowing that I was sort of different. So I grew up as what I thought to be partially sighted at the time. And then secondary glaucoma set in my teenage years, which caused the very gradual final deterioration of all light perception and so forth. So I've been totally blind for many, many years, over 20 years.
Long enough to actually become an expert at it, I would assume. And that's why we've got you here today. We, with macular degeneration, are all pretty much newly blind, unless we're in the 80s and 90s and acquired this disease as long ago as you did. And so we have a problem with that, having had vision for most of our life and then having to make that transition, or what we're calling crossing the line, from visual to non-visual. And so I think we're going to get into that a lot today. And one way we're going to do that is go to the next question. You have earned the unique honor, and this will have to do with what we would call persistence, I think, and going ahead and living your life in spite of loss of vision. You have earned the unique honor of being called, quote, the other blind guy on Mount Everest. Would you tell us a little bit about that fascinating experience?
Yes, thank you, Dan. Actually, I was listening very carefully to your introduction in the process of how I was selected to go to participate as part of the Mount Everest Base Camp team. Because I was waiting to hear an answer, I was hoping you'd get into that, because I'm still wondering, actually, how I was selected to be part of that. And kind of double back into our previous question and how I got into the blindness field, I think we probably have more in common, or that is, I have more in common with the Immaculate Generation community than one might think on the face of it, just because I think that this adjustment to blindness question is a... is not a simple one, and it's a journey, And that journey can take, for some of us, a lifetime, or for some of us, a shorter time, depending on a number of factors. I was asked 10 years ago, I'm not even sure why or how, but I know that I was on vacation in northern Pennsylvania, and I checked my home answering machine, and there was this message from Dr. Mark Maurer, president of the National Federation of the Blind. And my first response was, you know, he doesn't call me ordinarily for just any old reason, and I thought maybe I was supposed to be somewhere, or that maybe I was in trouble for something or other. And I called him back, and he asked me if I'd remembered this guy named Eric Weinmayer, and I remembered hearing him at former NFB conventions, national conventions, talking about, you know, climbing mountains and, you know, climbing ice faces, and I just thought, this guy's nuts, you know, that was my impression, and all of a sudden now I'm being asked if I wanted to be part of the base camp team to handle communications to get the message of the NFB out to the world as the first blind man to climb Mount Everest, attempted this feat. Well, you know, I was broadsided, I had no idea, so of course my first question was, well, you're kidding, right? And if anyone has ever heard a speech or talked to Dr. Maurer, he's got a great sense of humor, but not quite that flippant as that. So he definitely wasn't kidding, and he wanted an answer, and within 48 hours, the bottom line for me was, if I give up this chance, somebody else will have it, and I'll probably have the rest of my life wondering what it might have been like. So I jumped at it, mostly don't regret that decision. It was quite a fascinating trip and experience.
What would you say is the key ingredient to reaching that level of achievement and similar levels of accomplishment that you have achieved and that you know other people who have virtually no vision are able to achieve? What is that key ingredient?
You know, I'm trying to think of what that ingredient is, if it's a characteristic, if it's a personal attribute, or if it's the right words, the right technology, or the right... And I'm left at somewhat of a loss. I guess in my case, I was hungry for that, for an opportunity to have an impact in some way, or to have experiences that oftentimes people who are blind simply don't have, are not afforded, or as we're losing vision, whatever rate, we tend to limit our experiences and slow down and stop doing things. I was at a point in my life where lots of opportunities I saw sort of go by and sat waiting. And so here was a great opportunity to go somewhere that I'd never dreamed of going. So for me, I was hungry for it. And perhaps a little insanity doesn't hurt, but I just went for the opportunity. I think it's having the guts or not reason enough to accept a challenge like that when it's presented.
Do you think youth has a lot to do with that? I'm dealing with aging. Sometimes I just don't have the same sense of invulnerability that I had 30 or 40 years ago. Do you think just being young is helpful in a situation like that?
Dan, the easy answer would be to say, yeah, it has a lot to do with youth. But my experience tells me I am surrounded by people with whom I work and people that have inspired me who, you know, have me by quite a few years, who are embarking on careers and new skills and things that... I wouldn't necessarily think of 20 years ago for myself. So certainly youth has some part of it, but I think there are even increasing studies that show the brain's capacity to learn new skills even after 50 years old. So the capacity to do it is there. The willingness is what we're talking about, the, you know, being daring and getting out of our comfort zone. But my experience tells me that there are people doing this all the time, and people that I'm inspired by. I would add that on that Mount Everest expedition, among the four or five world records that were broken, was one Sherman Bull, who was a surgeon, the father of another summiter, who was 64 years old at the time. He broke the record for the oldest man to summit. The headline in the Nepal newspaper said, "Oldest man to summit Mount Everest."
Okay, that was an excellent answer, and I'm glad you didn't take the easy way out there and give us the easy answer. It isn't easy, is it, becoming blind or losing vision, but we can do something about it, and that's what we're talking about today. Here's the next question. You are committed to the belief that alternative techniques can help a blind or visually impaired person to match the abilities of his sighted counterparts. Do you think that is possible in every situation, Maurice?
Before I had embarked on my journey into this whole field of blindness, I'm not sure how I would have answered that. Probably no. What I've learned in my development in the field, professionally and personally, is, and what I've seen time and time again, is yes, it is possible, and it's possible in every situation, despite visual acuity, despite the visual condition, specific condition, and even additional challenges. I've just seen too many wonderful stories, miraculous stories of people who have regained their lives and done things that that they never would have thought of before the onset of vision loss. So I absolutely believe that it's not only possible, but that it's within sight to even expand those number of people that would take on challenges like that. So yes, I do.
And what are the most important skills for a visually impaired or blind person to acquire, in your opinion?
You know, there are very basic core skills of blindness that should be achieved, and it would be hard to single out what they are. Access to information, self-communication, you know, Braille or large print, travel skills. But I really think, since you're asking about the single most important, I believe has to do with one's mindset or attitude, or I like to call it philosophy, and I realize that people cringe sometimes at that description of it, but it's a way that we need to begin to think of the world, to think of ourselves, and to think of our disability, if you will, differently than we've been that's been ingrained in us to think. So the most important ingredient is to have that attitude change, and the only way that I know to achieve that, the only way I achieve that, is to be surrounded by people who reflect, who model those attitudes, people doing things that I sort of dismissed for myself because, after all, I was blind. And so it's being part of a community and seeing oneself as something more than the disability would have us believe about ourselves, which tends to be less.
We did find in a recent study that we were doing that ended up being our guide that up to 99% of skills, daily living skills that we have as visual person can be replaced, supplemented, or substituted for with non-visual skills. Do you agree with that figure, or am I just being optimistic?
I think you're being optimistic, but I think it's entirely realistic. Generally, I will sit down with a new student with whom I'm working or a newly blinded person and play this little game. I once did this with a group of first graders and said, try to think of something that blind people can't do. What can that be? And one smart aleck raised his hand and said, "See," and I couldn't argue with that. But by and large, people will come up with all kinds of careers and duties and tasks for which there's always, if I don't know specifically how to do a thing non-visually or using alternative techniques that might include low vision techniques, I know somebody who has. And until recently, the one thing that we had to put on that list was driving. And it's made quite a lot of press, but the technology is being put into place experimentally at this point, but that answers that question definitively, that driving, even driving, is not off limits to be done in an alternative fashion. It has to do with how we rewire our brains to think. We're wired for vision. There's no doubt about that. But can we rewire? Can we rethink how to do things? And the answer is absolutely.
You know, I would have had an answer for that child who said that we couldn't see, because we see in many ways, and I know you believe that too. That's where terms like "you see what I'm saying" comes from, things like that. So I think we still have an answer for that smart aleck little kid there that you were talking to. Let's go to our next question here. A common low vision rehabilitation model recommends a training period during which all skills are introduced, after which more intensive practice in specific skills is offered as needed. How effective has that been approach been in your field of work?
You know, it's that's a much bandied about discussion, and you know, I don't know that there are sufficient you know, scientific data that can say for a fact that one or another approach is, you know, statistically more effective. I think that that's one of the weaknesses of the blindness and low vision field, is that we need to compile that kind of research. But I'm familiar with a number of those models. I've worked in environments that offer the approach that you describe. You'll forgive me for using shorthand because there are pitfalls to that. But what you described, I have often referred to as a sort of cafeteria approach. You know, here are the skills that are available, and you can make up your mind. So when you think you might need Braille, come on back in a few years, or cane travel. Well, you don't travel that much now, and people take you to the grocery store. You know, maybe in a few years, if your vision gets worse, you might want to come back, and we'll teach you how to use the cane. The problem to me with that approach is I believe in a process by which people should try to get the fullest benefit of what a training program can offer in a comprehensive way, so that they can then be equipped to discern what skills are effective under what circumstances, depending on their visual acuity, depending on their level of activity. Many of the skills that we're talking about take time to learn. I don't recommend waiting until you lose enough vision to where you might then start thinking about using a cane or learning Braille, because that'll be a lot of time wasted, and it does take time to learn and to master these skills. So the short answer is, when people are presented with a cafeteria approach of rehabilitation, whether we could call it low vision rehabilitation or blindness rehabilitation, they may not know the full benefit of what those skills can offer them. They may not feel that they're up to the challenge to learn those skills. So it would take some time to be among competent instructors and other peers who have mastered those techniques, to begin to have the confidence, to build the confidence to feel like these skills can belong to them, that independence can really belong to them. So just taking a look at, I want a little bit of this and maybe a little bit of that later, what you tend to have is people returning to training over and over again, and I've seen that. And it's a little bit sad in that, you know, sometimes I think, well, they could have sort of gotten it the full meal all at once, in a one-stop, comprehensive, few months out of their life period of time.
Well, you know, I was one of those people who resisted low vision rehabilitation simply because my vision wasn't bad when I was diagnosed. And that's what we find with macular degeneration people and retinitis pigmentosa. Those are slow declines of vision over a period of years, starting with no visual symptoms at all. And that, of course, brings up the point as to when do we actually introduce low vision rehabilitation. And I know that's a difficult a question to answer, so I'm not even going to ask you that question as to when we would introduce it at what time. But I do agree with you that we need to be proactive. You mentioned in an email message this morning, I liked your analogy, that if a person is going to go to Mexico to live, let's say, and I'm stretching your analogy a little bit, would they wait until they got to Mexico to learn Spanish, or would they start learning Spanish before they went? And I liked that analogy that you drew, and I think that might have something to do with what you're saying there. And it kind of leads us into this next question about the resistance that many people have to learning new skills that would help them to improve their quality of life. How do you explain that, except for what I was just saying, where they just didn't feel like they needed it at the time? Or you might expound upon that too. But how would you explain that resistance that you run into as a rehab teacher, and I'm sure a frustration that you run into with people just say they don't need it?
Yes, it's a very interesting challenge, Dan. People you find, no matter what age and abilities, when they take up a thing that they love, that they're passionate about, it might be music, it might be cooking, it might be knitting, it might be listening to books on tape, name it, and they'll take it on with a gusto. And if it involves learning a new technology to do it, it's interesting that they'll find a way to do it. How independently or all that, leave that aside, but they'll find a way to get it done. The resistance to learning these new skills is tied very much to confidence and to one's self-perception as going through this experience of losing vision, however gradually. So what we're really dealing with is a person facing a challenge and thinking, am I up to it? Can I really do these things? And tied to this also is the very ubiquitous and always with us, social stigma of blindness. You can call it whatever you want. I use the word blind fairly generically in order to demystify or try to bring it into common parlance so that it's not a dirty word. If a person fits that description, legally blind, they can see pretty well, but they may be blind by definition of what they may have to use alternative, techniques to accomplish in a given day. It's that social stigma. That's the resistance. No one wants to be perceived as less, as somewhat less intelligent, slower. You need to raise your voice when you talk to somebody who's losing their vision because, of all of these misperceptions and public misunderstandings about blindness, that when we're losing vision, we're part of the public. Those are the things that we think about. So that it, blindness or vision loss of any kind tends to be something we want to hide and resist. So learning new skills that, putting a cane in your hand or putting a braille book in your hand or using these adaptive techniques, oh my gosh, that makes me kind of one of those, and I don't want to give in to that demon. But if we can get past it and help support one another in a positive atmosphere, again with lots of other blind role models of various visual acuities, whether it's macular degeneration, retinitis pigmentosa, whatever it is, but seeing what other people are doing and wanting to be part of that is part of the process of getting over that resistance. And it can happen. It is usually a matter of time and how one can process that and gets over the sometimes very paralyzing fear and grief and all those things that are associated with newly people losing vision relatively recently.
You probably know Dr. Bob Masoff. He and I had quite a long communication back and forth by email, and then he came on our site and did a webcast a year or so ago. But that was one of the things we discussed, and that was this social stigma of the word blind. And it occurs to me that the word blind has double meanings, and they tend to conflict with one another. The original meaning of blind, as I looked it up, etiology, is that the right word, of that word is an old German word, blinder, which means blunder. And it originally meant people who blunder are considered to be blind. Not that blind meant you didn't have vision. And somehow that became connected, and I've been able to trace it back to actually the St. James Version of the Bible. The translation of the word blind originally didn't mean that, but it was starting to be used in the translation of the Bible. Might have been the one that connected that to people who couldn't see. And so this really gets into a whole other area. Maybe what would you have, and I know this is not a fair question because we haven't even discussed it, what would be the problem with not calling people blind because of the connotation of the word, but using the word avisual or something of that sort, except that we would have to change all of the literature, all of the understandings, and retrain everybody. And possibly you might have a problem with avoiding the word blind because it really shouldn't have those connotations. Unfortunately, as I said, that's what the word originally meant. Without getting too much into this, do you have any comments about that?
Yeah, there's a lot of negative connotation with the word blind. And I don't want to sort of get into a whole, you know, how do we, can we approach this in a semantic way, or I really don't care what people call themselves, visually impaired, low vision, sightless, sight challenged, and you know, we can introduce all kinds of person first language, and I'm not much on the political correctness thing. What's important is what, you know, what's in a name, but it's how we feel about ourselves as a person with low vision. Our choices are that we can sort of hide behind it and say anything other than, you know, sighted or fully sighted or what have you. But even in the language, we get into all of these things that are sort of less than, you know, sightless or vision impaired, or, you know, what about me needs to be impaired, or so the reason I use the word blind is for a very conscious reason, again to demystify it, to kind of take the venom out of it. Very much based on the civil rights movement. There was a time in our nation when people of a different color or race would be anything but who they were and would try to pass for white or Anglo or what have you, or non-Catholic or whatever the case may be. And we can say that, you know, I'm a blind person with all the other characteristics that make me up as a human being, whether I have some vision or I don't have some vision. As a totally blind person, you know, I wonder why somebody would want to distinguish themselves as visually impaired, as though, you know, vision were the marker, as though there were a hierarchy that would set them apart from what I can do, or, you know, why that's a necessary thing. So I don't really care what words we use. You know, we can use blind or whatever it is. My only problem is keeping up with it as it would change from week to week.
And I totally agree with everything you just said. I hope that helped make it clear to other people that are listening to this, too. It's who we are. It's not what we are. And I know that's not a summary of everything you said. That just came to my brilliant mind. The next question I'd like to ask is, how important is patient education and self-determination in the success of a person's low vision rehabilitation? Maurice?
It's an excellent question, Dan, because it's critical. I mean, information is key to everything. We want to be, you know, in our society, an educated consumer, right? You know, going back to the previous question about traditional low vision rehabilitation models, or the model to which I subscribe, you know, I have an opinion about that. Others have opinions about traditional low vision rehabilitation. What really matters, though, is the person who will be the consumer of that training, and so. I recommend that people don't just come by and see us and see what we do, but they go, you know, to the next door or next state or across the country and see what other people are doing so that they can make an informed decision. It's critical to educate ourselves as much as we can about rehabilitation paradigms and models, as well as the research behind our condition, so that we can understand better about what we're seeing or think we're seeing or not seeing. So it's critical and should always be encouraged. By the way, the acquisition of the skills that I promote, non-visual skills in particular, but you know, the doors to that, just that type of information. People stop using computers. They stop communicating with their friends and families. And sometimes it's the you know, the way that opens up the world for seniors, for example, who really all they want to do is communicate with their grandchildren via email. Learning how to use a screen reader or screen enlargement program can open up that possibility for them.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm wondering if it wouldn't be helpful. One of the issues we brought up here today that you mentioned was that people tended to wait too long. They would come in, or they were expected to come in when they had a problem and have it taken care of. You called it the cafeteria approach. Unfortunately, that isn't always a practical situation. Another problem we have with obtaining knowledge and training in rehabilitation is the factor that of distance and time. Is there a low vision rehabilitation clinic or agency within a reasonable amount of distance or time from our homes? And how motivated are we to make that effort, especially in the beginning when we're not that familiar with it? Which brings me to our guide that I had put into the newsletter. And if you'll permit me, let me explain a little bit of that because people are listening to this webcast who don't have our newsletter. And so I want to kind of repeat what's in the newsletter to approach this next question. And the question is, would it be helpful to develop a tool for patients to use in evaluating their own needs and goals and for educating themselves about the available options? And you and I have been tossing this back and forth, and you have contributed to this guide. So I know that you your answer to that is yes, probably a qualified yes, because we're still working on it. But I wanted to go ahead and get this into this session this month because it's so pertinent to what we're saying. In the newsletter, I wrote on page 3, if you are in the intermediate to late stage of vision loss, you may be considering making that transition from visual to non-visual in some of your daily activities. And that's exactly what low vision rehabilitation is designed to help us with. But if such services aren't available to us, as I mentioned, maybe a self-help guide would be helpful. So MD Support has designed such a guide, which we will publish in this newsletter a section at a time through this coming year. It begins this month with the important first step of evaluating your personal needs and goals. And that's different for everyone. If you have internet access, you may read the entire guide on our website at www.mdsupport.org/guide.html. I'll repeat that again later. The guide is designed for people who are wanting to learn what alternatives exist to replace or substitute for or supplement their loss of vision. It's just as useful, however, to people who still have functional vision but would find it easier to supplement even though they don't actually need the non-visual skill at the time. I hope that was clear. For more information about how to use this guide, everybody, please look at page 3 of your newsletter. I'm not going to get into a description of it. For those who are don't have the newsletter because they're not a member of our IMDSG, if you would go to the website that I gave, and I'm going to repeat that, www.mdsupport.org/guide.html, the entire guide is there, including a link to the support research that goes behind it, and that is a living document. I actually am changing things every day in that to keep up with the latest. So it's something you would want to refer to often. Now, we're also offering a printed version of that, a Spira Brown printed version in very large print for people who don't have internet access who would like to have a copy of that entire thing. And we're going to be offering that at cost, what it cost MD Support to sell that. Now, the people in our groups are going to get it in their newsletters, but your facilitator may also access the entire guide right now from the internet, and you can see the whole thing at once if you'd like. So that's my commercial for that. We're excited about this new project, and I would like to just have you say a few words about it, Maurice. I know you have just been introduced to it yourself, even though you've been inspiring me to work more on it, and you've been adding some things to it, and I hope you stay with it, with me, and we can maybe get something going with this. Would you like to say a few words about this approach? And don't worry about hurting my feelings. I don't fall in love with anything I do. If there's something that we need to improve, or if you just don't feel like this is going to be just the right thing, feel free to say so. Maurice?
Well, Dan, I did read the guide, and we've talked about the guide over the phone and in several ways, and if one has to appreciate the obvious, love and effort that you put into this working document, and as much as we make this available to others, other people may want to add to it, and it actually is a very useful tool. Somebody can sit at home and read this on their computer, or have someone read it to them, whatever. And go down the list, and it might really enlighten them to see, maybe it'll show them, gee, these are some of the activities that I'm not doing anymore, that maybe I could be doing, and inspire people to maybe look into ways that it can be done. So I do think it's a very, very useful tool. One of the things I'm reminded of is I used to run a program that the NFB launched and is evolving all the time that makes over 300 newspapers available, for free, to anybody who wants access to it. It's a free program. It's available in just about every state. You know, that's a privilege that if we're cited, you know, we don't have access to that. You've got to buy the paper at the newsstand still. You can get it online, but they're charging for that more and more. So this is a way we can read up to 300 newspapers and a lot more magazines, including AARP, by the way, through an almost human-sounding mechanical voice. So that's an example of some of the resources that you include on that guide, which is exciting. It's a dynamic list, as it's always changing, and hopefully will give people some ideas. And, you know, when you talk about social activities, dancing, going out to dinner, people don't do these things anymore. They won't go to a restaurant for Valentine's Day because it's dark, and they don't want to be embarrassed, and they can't see their food, you know. And so I just want people, whatever it takes for them, you know, to bring this to light, they would seek to make the phone calls and go visit an agency or a group or low vision clinic that can help show people the possibilities. And certainly through this medium, contact us and ask questions about how do you do this or how do you do that. And it's a wonderful discussion to have. So keep up the great work with it, Dan. I'll continue to follow it. I hope other people on this list and this forum will add things that that they've learned can be done. And it could be a very lively and, again, dynamic piece of work.
Well, I appreciate your positive thoughts on that. And I hope you not only follow it, but I hope you help lead the way with this guide and become a major part of that. Because it is, as I say, a living document. It's going to continue to change. It's totally free for anybody to use. Other organizations can take it and expand upon it. And that's what it's out there for. It's totally open to the public to use as they want. Kind of a wiki, I guess. It's kind of a wiki. I'm going to turn this program over now to Dr. Huggett. Ed Huggett is my really good friend. He's been with us since the beginning with this program, and he always runs the question and answer session. And so I'm just going to simply turn the program over to Dr. Ed, and he will invite people to type some questions in up there if they'd like. Ed, the program is yours.
Well, thank you, Dan, very much. And Maurice, thank you so much, too, for the presentation. I really enjoyed listening to it, and I'm going to go back over this one, too. There's a lot in there, and I want to be able to take in all that you had. I'm going to open up the floor to questions, and hopefully the participants today will type in some questions, and moderators in each of the locations, if you would, go ahead and take questions and type them in for us. But while we're waiting for questions, Maurice, I'm going to throw one out to you. I'm going to throw out a question, and you can pick and choose what part you want to take, almost like a smorgasbord here. So you pick and choose what part of the question you want to tackle. I know as a rehab trainer, you come across many ages of people that are on the way to various levels of vision impairment. What, based on age, maybe teenagers versus 20s versus middle age versus later years, what challenges are characteristic of the different ages? I'm kind of curious to hear your perspective on that. What challenges do the different age groups have as characteristic, and maybe what you like to do, and what you like to or how you like to approach those challenges or those characteristics to help people with maybe their vision impairment, or maybe with their activities for daily living, or whatever difficulty or positive aspect they're having. So that's a big question. Pick and choose what you want. I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Thanks, Dr. Huggett. Actually, I love that question. I love it a lot, and it spurs me to make a bit of a confession. You know, I've been in this field for a dozen years, and my confession is this. You know, I've worked with adults, I've worked with children, I've worked with youth, I'm working with seniors. And whenever I'm contemplating, I'll give you an example. When I worked with adults, during the summer, we would close down the rehabilitation training center, and a flood of youth, you know, with all their culture and all this, and I just remember just thinking, oh my God, you know, I don't know if I can survive this summer. But something happens when they descend on the center. You know, their youth, their exuberance, their curiosity. I become all of a sudden, you know, 17 again, And at the end of it, I wonder where the summer went. That happens when I work with children. How am I going to work with these children? What do I know about working with kids? But it happens, and I work with families. And I now work with seniors. And I'm not going to admit here that I had all these preconceived notions about what that must be like. But surely I went into it with those. But the beauty of my job, you know, what do they say? Those who can do and those who can't teach, right? The beauty of my job is that I learn from the people that I work with, because what I'm trying to do is to get back to normalcy, get back to a level of life of what people would be doing normally if they had their vision. And so we can explore that and say, well, what are you not doing that you'd like to be doing? And it's wonderful to share that journey with people in their, however you want to put it, their twilight years and their retirement years. I'm a little envious, but that's just me. But the kinds of things they would like to get back to being to doing. I was working with a gentleman in the Western in Western Maryland yesterday who talked about being activist in his church and being served communion, you know, having it brought to him rather than participating like everyone else in his particular church where they approach the pulpit. And I thought, what a great you know, travel goal, O&M goal. So that's a goal he's going to be working on. So I love living vicariously or together with the lives of the people that I work with every day. So what group is more challenging, or what set of challenges is specific to certain age groups? I love shattering misconceptions, and every day that I come to work with whatever group I'm working with, those conceptions continue to be shattered. And I love it, and hope that I'll shatter a few more as I approach my later years as well.
Oh, very good. I really love that answer. Proctor Daumenholm has a question, and if there's any other questions, go ahead and submit them now while we're going over these. That question is, can you give a specific example of one of the alternative ways of coping with vision loss? So can you give a specific example of one of the alternative ways of coping with vision loss?
Wow. You know, that's a really loaded question, because there's a million things that one could conceivably come up with. I know a few years ago, I have a little boy, and at the time he was maybe 9 or 10, and a neighbor had said, you know, let's go ice skating. Want to take your boy ice skating, and wouldn't you like to go? And I thought, yeah, that'll be fun, and I was getting ready to go and everything, and I thought, I've been ice skating before. And then as it was sinking in and we were getting closer to the ice rink, I thought, oh, wait, you know, I was 12 when I went, and to be honest with you, I had some vision then, and I thought, gee, how's this going to go? You know, what are the alternative techniques to ice skating? It's not something I teach on a regular basis. So fortunately, my son was new to it too, so he's kind of hanging out by the wall, which gave me time to act like I was helping him out while I'm sort of getting used to the ice at the same time. And before you knew it, you know, I'm coaxing him out onto the ice as I'm coaxing myself out onto the ice, and we were out there skating away. And he went and played video games, and I stayed out there on the ice because I had such a good time using my cane and using alternative skills that I've learned and that I teach to skate. Well, that led into there was an event in Dallas, Texas, or Atlanta, Georgia, I think it was, where there was a March for Independence, and this is a great fundraising activity to bring awareness to the capabilities of blind people and raise some money in the process, and people were going to be walking 5 kilometers, and I thought, how am I going to go to people and ask them to give money for just because I'm just going to walk 5 kilometers? I do that in a matter of course. So I said, I need a gimmick. Well, I've been ice skating. I've heard of rollerblading. Why don't I do that? So I had to learn to rollerblade, and I got out, and it wasn't as hard as I thought it would be, except I hadn't figured out that after I was on the rollerblades and got up and it was rolling around, I hadn't figured out how to stop. So that's an example, I guess, of movement and using alternative techniques to move around, using a cane, heighten, you know, learning to strengthen the skills that we already have, our senses of hearing and touch and smell, senses that we often don't even pay attention to because our brains are so wired to vision. Which, by the way, when we master these skills, if we have a little residual vision, we actually can learn to use that vision better by not depending on it so much and overworking it for things that we could be doing in other ways. So I don't know if that answers the question, but I could talk about this all day.
No, that did. That was great. Thank you very much. Well, looks like there's no more questions. I want to ask one more question. Before I ever come on to the presentations here, I go on the internet and really try to find out as much as I can about a person on the internet. And I've got to admit, you're all over the internet for sure, especially with Twitter and Facebook and so on. Any particular way you like people to follow along with what you do or information that you would like to provide for other people?
Well, I may be all over the internet, but there's usually only in one sort of sphere, and that is that in my involvement in my work and in my, I don't have much of a life and outside of work, I'm mostly involved with activities in the community of blind people and friends that like to do things. I have a very good social life. But through the internet on www.bism.org, there's so many things on our website that people maybe wouldn't have even thought of by going to our website. We have DVDs that show very specifics how we teach some of the non-visual techniques that we teach here at BISM to seniors, and it's free to watch it online. The National Federation of the Blind website has a wealth of information. If you like to read, you can read all day. There's audio files you can listen to all day. There's videos, and there's just anything unimaginable. You can read about the Blind Driver Challenge and exciting things. So that's pretty much where you can find me. The community of the blind, or the organized blind movement, as I call it, is a family. We know each other, and that family, the extended family, includes, vision specialists and professionals across the board, and we love each other and fight with each other just like any family members would. So I don't know if that specifically answers the question. I'm Blind Wanderer on Twitter if you wanted to follow me, but mostly I would say go to my website where I work, Blind Industries and Services, BISM.org or NFB.org. That's where I spend most of my time.
All right, very good. Thank you so much. I was hoping you'd mention Twitter because I've seen your tweets on there. So anyhow, I think that'll wrap it up for us today. We'll be ending a little bit early. That'll give a chance for the different groups and participants to have some activity and some social time on your own. So Dan Roberts, I'm going to turn it back over to you. And I do want to, before we go, just mention the Macular Degeneration Foundation. They're just wonderful supporters of the IMDSG, as well as all the participants and all the listeners that will be listening in as the months and years go by. So thank you so much on behalf of the IMDSG. Thank you. And Dan Roberts, back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Huggett. And thank you very much, Maurice Perret, for coming in and being our guest today. We've learned quite a bit from you. I think you've opened some eyes, no pun intended, to the situation that we sometimes find ourselves in, and that's how do we cross that line from what we're so used to, the visual world, to using some techniques that can help us that are non-visual. And I hope everybody will go ahead and read through the newsletter, go to the site that I gave you where the guide is, and let that be your guide. If you don't have a low vision rehabilitation specialist or an O&M or anybody you're working with, the question was asked by Proctor Endowment if we could give specific examples of the alternate ways of coping with vision loss. Well, that's what the guide has in it. One example after another, hundreds of things that you can do. So go ahead and go online and take a preview of that. And as I said, I'll also be putting that out in book form and also through your newsletters. So there's where your answers will lie for now. And if you have more answers or more ideas that you'd like to contribute to that guide, please let us know. Send them to me, and you'll be surprised. They'll probably end up in the guide if you've got some ideas that we haven't thought of. Maurice, thank you one more time, and thank you to Rob and Dan and Shirley for sitting on your side there and helping you out. And I'm looking forward to next month when we're going to have the exclusive opportunity to preview the new documentary that just came out last year called Going Blind, produced by filmmaker Joseph Lovett, who has done some specials for HBO and is quite a professional in his field. He himself has started losing his vision to glaucoma, and he has produced a beautiful documentary on this subject that has been showing in some theaters around the country, but it's kind of exclusive. So he's given me permission to preview it especially the parts that have to do with macular degeneration. And so I hope you'll be with us then to see bits and pieces of that film and hear some of the audio from that. So until then, we'll let Maurice say maybe a few words of goodbye, and then we'll sign off. Maurice?
Dan, I really do want to thank you very sincerely, as well as the people who will be listening in on this now and later on, for welcoming me so warmly to what I feel like is another branch on our family tree. I do feel like it's a community where we should be open and discuss anything that comes to mind. It's stimulating to me. It's exciting to me. And the message, I hope, is that no matter what degree that people are beginning to see changes in their vision, pursue all the research and everything you can with your eye care, but just know that life doesn't need to end or even diminish, that there are ways that you can find to enjoy all those things. There's no substitute for 20/20 vision, but there are ways you may not expect that might be better, and keep that in mind, consider it, and let's talk more about it. I do thank you, and I'll be looking for news on the website and our further correspondences. Thank you so much.
And on that very positive note, we wish everybody a good month, and we'll see you in March when we preview the film Going Blind. Everybody take good care of yourselves and each other, and we'll see you then. Goodbye.